Roll sound, Scotty.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
Send it for me, man.
I got a TV set. I got a hi-fi. You can take it all.
Do it. Hey, what's the catch?
The catch is it's dangerous.
Please do it.
That ain't the catch. It's the fun.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stinking Paws podcast celebrating 10 years of reviewing movies. Some good, some not so good. Hi, I'm Scott. With me is Paul. Hello.
Good evening.
It's a very special episode tonight, mate.
Why's that?
Because we've got somebody sitting at the other end of a Skype line, and we've just had a conversation, and it is so remiss of us that he has never actually been invited onto this show in the past 10 years. We're not too sure. We don't actually know.
Is there a reason for that?
No reason whatsoever.
About to find out.
Listeners may recognise that voice. It's Ben Taylorson. Hello, Ben.
Hello. Good evening, gentlemen.
No, mate. Good evening. Possibly best known as the host of the House of Hammer podcast, Rated H, Mr. Chris Sandwich Man. I don't know if he actually had a title with the whole thing. Was going the fiance of Gok Wan.
Yes. I prefer the term sensation. Is how I tend to be known. In media circles.
Are you still a sensation, or has the sensation waned a wee bit?
No, it's a past tense thing now, but former sensation, Ben Taylorson, is how I like to be known.
He had his 15 minutes.
He had more than 15 minutes in America.
He was mentioned on, was it that that Channel 5 show, Packed Lunch.
Packed Lunch.
Yeah.
Also, Ben, were you on American Breakfast TV in Boston or somewhere, wasn't it?
Chicago. Chicago Breakfast TV, yes. And I did an advert for Walker's Crisps as well.
You did, yes. Yeah, an online ad. Yes, I saw that.
Yeah. It was just a crazy 15 minutes during lockdown, mate, basically. And
it was surreal. I can't even actually believe it really happened. I've eaten all the crisps as well. So, it sounds like I'm joking when I say I got paid in crisps, but I legitimately got paid in crisps.
We've seen the photos, mate, where you had them piled up in the hallway. Yeah, absolutely.
The income has stopped, has it?
Well, it's been consumed.
So Ben has been part of this podcast in spirit for nearly the 10 years, Ben. It must be. I mean, you were part of the original Pod Pals group that all got together way back when. I mean, you were with Matt podcasting at the time, weren't you, mate? Is this how it all started?
Yeah, it did. I mean, we all started around the same time. And you know, we're talking the sort of dark ages of the dinosaurs here. So, there was considerably fewer podcasts out there. And we managed to sort of find each other all doing similar but not the same things.
Yeah.
And we all have a similar attitude, you know, to how we do things. And we all respect each other's opinions, and we all create the kind of content that each other wanted to listen to. And we gravitated towards each other, you know, pretty easily. And it wasn't long before we were, quite a tight group of, you know, amateur podcasters.
And we're still amateur podcasters, apart from one who we don't talk about. and it's just incredible. I mean, this whole we've been saying this. We've been just going back over the last 10 years, celebrating this 10th anniversary. And it's just incredible that the fact that from something just a bit bizarre. You know, podcasting back then was not well known, Ben. We're talking, yeah, there was probably thousands out there.
I think Charlie mentioned in one of the previous episodes, it was mainly proper professionals that were doing it. The amateur side hadn't really picked up at that stage. It was your stars that were doing a few of them, or it was very educational, the ones that were doing them. It wasn't, say, just the average Joe blogs on the street.
I can tell you
why I got involved, and it's not particularly glamorous. It isn't a story that doesn't make me look particularly good either, but I got a new phone around the time, and it had the ability to download podcasts, and I'd never heard of a podcast probably prior to what would we be looking at now. So it's sort of 2012, around 2011. It must have been about 2011 when I started getting interested in it. And I thought, oh, God, great. So these are effectively like little radio programs. You type in the thing you're interested in, and up comes some people talking about it. So I think the first few searches I did for things like John Carpenter and his films, you know, that kind of thing. And I listened to them and thought, you know, they're interesting because the content is what I'm looking for, but they're quite shit, is what I thought. and I thought I like the idea of doing this, and I think, you know, not that I can do it better, you know, in terms of, you know, production values or whatever, but I feel as though if these people have got something to say and people listen to it, then I can do that as well, and that's genuinely how I got involved in it.
I think that's how I started, which was, you know, this harbouring to be a closet DJ. But like we said in previous podcasts, you know, the last thing you want to admit to being is a somebody that grew up in the 70s and wanting to be a DJ.
I've been there.
But similar to you, Ben, it was the fact that if you wanted to listen to, I don't know, some sort of like audio documentary on some sort of movie history type subject, the only option you had was to listen to Radio 4 and hope that there would be something broadcast whenever you were available, you know, or you could put a cassette in the recorder and get it at some point later. And podcasts just opened up this whole world. Exactly the same for me. It was like, wow, if I just type in classic Hollywood movies, there are 1,000 people talking about the stuff that I'm interested in. And then when I realized that they weren't in a studio.
Yeah.
And they were sitting in a front room or across a Skype line or sitting in a bedroom or, in Adam's case, in a cupboard under the stairs, whatever it may have been.
I thought, made him sound like Harry Potter.
It was incredible. Adam's like initial humble beginnings in that cupboard under the stairs. It's so funny. You just think, okay, well, if somebody can do that, how difficult must it be? I mean, Ben, what was your like initial equipment like when you first started out? I mean, you've got a lovely sort of like mics out there we can see, but did you go cheap and cheerful or did you go like all out?
I had an iPad. That's all I used.
An iPad, so you recorded directly into the iPad?
And yeah, two of us sitting around one iPad talking into it was all that we did, didn't we? I think after a few weeks, possibly before we ever recorded the first actual podcast, I bought a microphone. But it was like, I think it was, you know, it was the equivalent of what you used to do when you're a kid, when you're buying a tennis racket from Argos, the second cheapest one you could buy. You know, I'm not buying like the Dunlop, I'll have the, you know, that's the cheapest Wilson you've got. It's that kind of thing, you know, and it was, that was the equivalent that we did, me and Jones. And, and we went from there, but that was the only equipment I had was the iPad and the cheap mic.
Wow. So did like, you two used to get together in the same room. It wasn't over Skype or anything like that. You used to get together.
Yeah, I used to drive over every once a week. I used to drive over to his house, and we'd sit round a tiny little table in the quietest room in his house that he had at the time. And yeah, and it used to take about 3 hours to record every. I don't know. I mean, our kids were tiny at the time. I don't know how I found the time for all this nonsense when, you know, they were really little, and it was every week. You know, and every week we'd go to the cinema one night together, me and him, and then we'd have the pick from the vault. And I think we put something like 50, 60 episodes out. We never missed a week. Yeah. And God knows how we managed it. I really don't know.
Wasn't there episodes where you did like, not necessarily live, but you did stuff walking back from the cinema. Am I remembering this rightly?
I think the star was in the decline at that point. But yeah, the infamous time was that we went to I remember when I knew that the days for the JT were numbered, was that we were doing something else. We were taking some photos for it that I was submitting to a competition in a different podcast actually, because I wanted to take some pictures of Whitby. But I thought, we'll record the podcast while we're out here, and we sat outside and recorded this podcast, and we didn't have the wind cover or anything, so it was utterly shy. Got harassed by a massive seagull. Had to edit out loads of that because of this. And I just thought, I think this might be the interest might be waning a little bit here.
We can't. I know we're sort of celebrating our 10th anniversary, Paul, but I can't sort of lead this conversation without mentioning The Dog Never Dies.
Mm.
One of my favourite podcasts of all time. Now, Ben, how many episodes did that run for, mate?
Part of five or six. Want many?
Is that all it was? Come on, there must be more than that.
It's like people think of Fawlty Towers, don't they? About 30 episodes. No, there was only five or six. It's very. I mean, my hat is off to anybody who does a podcast single-handedly because it's very difficult. And I mean, it was partially down to my idiosyncrasies. That I insisted, to myself that I had to turn one out one a week, and if I wasn't doing that, then I might as well just, hurl it all against the wall. And I think it's, again, as I alluded to, I had other things going on in my life, and I still have the passion to do that one day, because I think there is a real niche for a disaster films podcast, and I've written and done the preparation work over the years many, many times, including as recently as last year, where I mean I've effectively got the script written for an opening monster episode, but. There's only so much I can fit in to my life, and don't want to spend all night every night sat around a computer talking to myself into a microphone.
Ben, if ever it does make a resurgence or a re-emergence, and you need somebody to talk about The Swarm or San Andreas,
San Andreas,
The Swarm is in first, because I've watched most of the disaster films that I watch. I watch with my son when he was growing up, and he's never forgiven me for The Swarm. three hours long that film is, and the only good bits of that film are the scene when the kid hides in the dustbin to escape the killer bees. That's cracking. And then when the bees destroy or blow up a nuclear power station, that's exactly. You can't argue with that. But the rest of it, garbage.
Disaster movies are all about, mate. Absolutely. You and I both have an undying love for Dante's Peak as well, I believe. I think that's one of your favourites.
I like that.
Yeah, Paul's a fan.
Piers Brosnan.
And what's her face from Terminator, isn't it? Yes.
Linda Hamilton.
Yeah. And if ever The Dog Never Dies makes a resurgence, mate, I'm on board with you, mate. Please invite me on, because I've got...
An opening, Dante's Peak. Spectacular.
Absolutely.
You could spend a whole hour talking about that woman who dissolves in the acid lake.
I was going to say the acid lake is the actual bit that the old woman that refuses to come down from the mountain.
Skeletor's grandma, yeah.
There is a market still out there for, an audience still out there for disaster movies. We haven't done that many disaster movies, if truth be told, on this podcast in 10 years.
No, I don't.
2 Minutes to Midnight? What was the Charlton Heston? Charlton Heston is in all of them.
All the 70s ones. Yeah. 2 Minute Warning, is that what you
mean? 2 Minute Warning.
Yes, we don't. Is that a disaster movie as such? It's not quite.
Well, let's talk to Ben, because Ben is. It has all the classic tropes of a disaster
movie. It does. It's because every element of a disaster film is in that. It's an ensemble. Yeah. It leads to the thing. You can see the way in which it plays out, the all of the stories interconnect, and there is a catastrophe at the end. It's a man-made catastrophe. So it is a disaster film. There is an infamous TV cut of that film, which I've never seen, which adds another 2 hours on, where they contextualize. They change, because in the film, he's like a white supremacist, just basically nutball.
Yeah. But
in the TV edit, they turn it into the cover for a robbery at a nearby furniture shop or something.
What?
So the whole thing is staged as a distraction from something else that's happened.
I've never seen it.
We need to see this. Yes.
Okay.
Round about the same time, mid-70s. Mm. 1976, Marathon Man, which is why we're here.
Mm.
We reviewed this movie, I think it was about 8 years ago. It was just myself and Charlie.
It would have been, I can tell you, it would have been 9 years ago, mm-hmm. almost exactly.
How do you know that?
I picked this film to talk to you about for a very specific reason. Mm-hmm. Because have I ever explained this to you before?
No, we were sort of wondering why today Paul and I were talking as to why you chose this movie. And I had a theory, but go on.
You'll have to indulge me with a tear-jerking backstory, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
So 9 years ago, you know, and probably the people who are listening, some of them have heard mm-hmm. me witter on about this before, I was diagnosed with cancer.
Yes.
And it was all very quick, and I was diagnosed one day, and I was operated on 2 days later, as the nature of the cancer was. And I underwent the operation in the afternoon and obviously was out for most of it, had a blood transfusion, was quite unwell. And by the time the night came out and the drugs had worn off a little bit, I couldn't sleep. And so to get me through the night, I listened to a podcast, and the podcast was you talking about Marathon Man. And to that day, the episode has stuck with me because it was like my friends were there for me in a very, very difficult time for me. So there you go.
And you've chosen to talk about it now.
Yeah. It's really uplifting, isn't it?
So, that's really nice. I mean, it's a shame that Charlie's not here, because Charlie was part of that podcast and you've been left with Paul, unfortunately.
Yeah. So, yeah. You definitely got the roar in there.
So, I mean, my theory, like the reason why you chose this, which I think you may have mentioned this story to me, which is horrible that I've forgotten. The fact that it's probably a lovely opportunity for you to talk about something that isn't a fucking horror film for once.
True. Yeah. Yes, that's fair.
That's how you spend your podcasting time now, mate, is talking about horror films.
Yeah, horror films are 50s noirs, as it would appear.
50s noirs, yes. At the moment. Hammer horror doesn't exist, does it, at the moment?
We're getting there. We're creeping ever closer.
And also the fact that, you know, marathon running or long distance running is dear to your heart as well. So I'm wondering if that was sort of like the reason behind it as well.
It's quite funny, actually, because I have very recently, and then in the last month, I have retired from the world of running.
No.
I have decided that I've done it. I've run 5 marathons and more half marathons than I can remember. Mm-hmm. But I hurt my back really badly a couple of years ago. I slipped a disc in my back and it really shook me because it was a really debilitating injury. Mm. And I've never got back into it properly since. And you know, the older you get, I'm not injured or anything, but the older you get, if your body's telling you this isn't really a very good idea, then I've decided to listen to it. And I mean, who knows, I might go back to it, what, you know, in 10 years time or something. Yeah. I don't know, but yes, I've kind of taken a break from that. But yeah, it's funny, I when I'm watching this and you watch it with a runner's sort of eye, and you think, oh, you've already gone out with your hoodie on for your complete tit, you know. And you see, right. he's got his stopwatch down his pants. What's going to chafe like a bastard unless he's fast for himself? You know, and you're watching all these things. You go, I don't believe that man's run a marathon in his life.
We are going to bring these sort of things up in a minute when we get to the review proper, because, you know, Dustin Hoffman being the method actor obviously didn't do his research, you know, as best as he could have done.
He always seemed to be running like the top half of his body was in front of his legs, if you know what I mean. He was like
a cartoon character.
Yeah. He never... You saw all the other runners pass him and when they were making comments about timing and whatever. And you're thinking, he just looks like he's run 20 yards full pace and done nothing else. He didn't seem natural like a runner. As good as Dustin Hoffman's acting is, it didn't seem like he was a genuine jogger stroke runner or whatever.
Well, what we're going to do, let's take a break, because what we need to talk about at some point, Paul mentioned to me earlier about what's the relevance of it being Marathon Man or him being a runner or whatever throughout the movie, apart from the fact that he runs away to escape at some point. Let's take a break. Let's play the trailer. We'll be back after this.
Trailer. want to speak to you.
I don't know anything.
And I'd like to use you as possible bait.
Help! Help!
It's not safe.
Help! Is it safe?
Is it safe?
No, it's not safe. It's very dangerous. You're probably the wealthiest and most wanted Nazi left alive.
I'm positive your brother meant to rob me when I leave the bank with my diamonds.
No, I don't know anything.
Well,
can I trust you?
You never could. You're uncontrollable. What you offer us is valuable, but it's not worth the chaos you're causing.
Where is he?
No! Now, when the gap gets too large between what the FBI can handle effectively and what the CIA doesn't want to deal with, that's where we come in.
What do you do exactly?
We provide.
Provide what?
Anything.
Were you Sal's mistress?
I never even met him.
Is it safe?
Marathon Man.
Okay, so that's Marathon Man, released in the UK 1976, directed by John Schlesinger, starring Dustin Hoffman, Roy Scheider. The summary, the plot summary according to IMDb. Now, these are always in question when we read these.
Yeah, some of them are really spot on. Some are so vague you wouldn't have a clue what the movie's about.
Okay, let's see how this one goes. After the shocking murder of his older brother, a New York... Right, and again, older brother, not that much older. A New York history student finds himself inexplicably hounded by shadowy government agents on the trail of a Nazi war criminal who is trying to retrieve smuggled diamonds.
That is a bit of a giveaway.
Just a bit.
Yeah.
That's like doing Psycho saying after Janet Leigh is killed in the show.
Well, Roy Scheider is a typical Janet Leigh character, surely. He's second build. Or top build, I don't know. Dead within, what, 20 minutes, 25 minutes?
No, it's about 50 minutes, 60 minutes.
Is it right the way?
Yeah.
Okay.
But he hasn't been in it much up to that point. He's only been in it a couple of times before he dies, so you could be forgiven for thinking it's early. It's just he hasn't. He must have had 5 minutes screen time up until that point.
Before we get right deep into this, Ben, what's your history with this movie? How many times have you seen?
I think I've seen it 3 or 4 times. Watching it for this was probably the first time I've watched it in a few years. But yeah, I've seen it a few times.
This is interesting with regard to Paul, because I thought Paul was familiar with this movie. First time watch.
Heard about certain scenes in it, which we'll get to. Didn't know a single thing about the movie, to the point where I actually thought it was something to do with running.
Just knew the title, that was it.
I just knew Dustin Hoffman was in it and it was something to do with running, or thought it was something to do with running. How wrong was I?
and Ben, Paul sort of sent me a text as he was sitting down to watch it. He was in about 15, 20 minutes in or something.
Yeah, about that.
The text sort of went, I don't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah,
fair as well. I also
it was WTF is going on. I don't understand this film.
Now, the thing is that first 20, 25 minutes, I like the fact that it is sort of disjointed, or there's like a story going on here, then you get something happening here and you don't know what the link is. The only thing I can sort of associated with is, you guys are both familiar with Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The beginning of that, where, you know, you get the scene where they find the aeroplanes in the desert, and then you go to India and the guys are saying they heard these voices calling from the skies, mm. and then something else. And it's like, these things are all totally unrelated, but you know that you'll have the satisfaction of the payoff in about 10, 15 minutes time when it all sort of gels together. This is the feeling I always get with Marathon Man, is when you get the beginning sequence with a random sort of black and white footage of a famous marathon runner whose name I can't remember to start with, going into a guy going into a bank and getting some diamonds, then this clash of people in a car chase in New York.
Proper road rage.
Yeah. But none of it actually makes sense, and you don't realise that all of them actually link together. For me, I watch this movie every couple of years. I really love this film. I've watched it so many times. Ben's seen it a few times. First time watch for a few years. Let's just go to Paul first, mate. Sorry, just go. How were you feeling in that first 20 minutes, mate?
To be honest, it was about 45 minutes in. I still was very confused as to what's happening. And usually, if it's a film I haven't seen, I will not read the synopsis, because I don't want to give anything away. I want to be surprised. I want to watch it as if I was watching it the day it came out. I read the synopsis. I went back to the film, I think it was a day or two later, before I watched the rest of it. And it was, having read the synopsis, it gave me a better understanding of what the hell I was watching and why it sort of skipped from blooming the road rage to Dustin Hoffman and the girl in the library and whatever, and it gave me some idea of where the film was going. I think if I hadn't have done that, I would have really sat there confused for a lot longer. Okay. Before, because it's not very clear at all until much, much deeper into the film, where it starts to tie together the Nazis and everything and the diamonds and his brother's connection. I must say, personally, on first watch, I didn't enjoy it that much. But knowing the whole story now, if I was to watch this again in a couple of years' time, I think I might enjoy it more, because I won't be so bemused by the start of it.
Ben, you haven't seen it for a few years. You've been sort of familiar with it. You know, you would have known the outcome. You would have known the whole plot from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like this time around?
Well, I think Paul makes a valid point there, because I think it's not really until Dustin Hoffman's taken on his post-dental exposition car ride, where all of the blanks are finally filled. I mean, you can piece, obviously, the broad strokes of it together as you go. But I think it's the way in which it's edited and the way it doesn't need me to tell anybody that it's based on a book, but it's one of those films that comes across like a novel, and it comes across like you're missing a narrator's voice or you're missing some of the minutiae that might give you a chance to, you know, finish the chapter, lie in bed awake for 10 minutes thinking, oh yeah, that's how that piece is together. But obviously you haven't got that particular benefit when you're watching it as a film. So I think it is quite misleading. I also think it's one of those things that it's guilty of not changing genres, but it becomes a film you don't expect it to be based on the opening. You know, by the end, people are getting shot in the face and stabbed, and you're thinking, oh, okay, I didn't really see all of this blood, but I didn't see that shootout at the, you know, sort of Little House on the Prairie coming. But I think it is maybe purposefully ambiguous at the beginning to, you know, sort of set up a bit of intrigue. But to the point where I think it definitely does leave the viewer. I would agree with Paul. I the first time I watched it, I remember thinking, I have no idea what's going on. Why is that Jewish man driving into a flaming fireball with that, you know, German guy? I have no idea what's going on here. You know, and who are these people? And they're dead now. And oh, they're not mentioned again. Why do I care about these people? You know, it's like, oh, he's Roy Scheider in a French cafe. What's he got to do with anything? Yeah, then he's Dustin Hoffman. Oh, he's running again. Brilliant. You know, and it takes 20 minutes. And you think, but none of these things are like interconnected in any way.
Oh, I'm glad it's not me, right, just me.
First time I watched it, when it had its premiere on BBC, whatever, in the early 80s, I caught it from the scene in the hotel where Roy Schneider gets attacked by the Asian guy with the rope.
Sorry.
I missed all of that coming up.
One quick thing on that scene, and there's a few holes I will pick throughout this movie. When he's got the cheese wire or whatever, right, across the back of his hand.
Yes.
Did you see how obvious the fake back of his hand was? If you look, it's about twice as thick as his normal hand should be into the blood bag. It was just like, it's literally someone had strapped on some flesh-coloured bag full of a liquid.
Roy Scheider's squib.
Yeah. I mean, I know it was 76 and special effects.
I've never noticed that in the 12 times I've seen this.
Oh, there's another one I'll pull up on later, but we'll carry on.
First time I watched this movie, that was the opening point for me seeing the movie.
Okay, so you've missed like 50 minutes of the movie.
I missed Angry German, Angry Jewish guy in the
road rage, which again, 1976, everyone thinks road rage is a recent thing, like 90s onwards perhaps, but obviously happened in America back then as well, because they were proper angry with each other.
It was even better as well, because they're proper like metal blocks of cars, so you can just keep banging them off each other. And no insurance claim going in, it's just like, fuck you.
And then we get the typical almost cartoon type sequence where what's going to come across the road? Is it going to be two guys carrying a pane of glass? Is it going to be a fruit lorry? You know, a cart full of like oranges or something? No, it's a tanker. Of course it's going to be a tanker. And there's a Jewish wedding going on the side. And nobody was that surprised, actually, when it all happened.
It's a weekly occurrence.
Not all the time in New York.
Not another heating oil truck.
But I never saw any of this. And the first time I watched the movie, it started at the Roy Scheider in the hotel thing being attacked. And instantly I was gripped, because I've gone into the movie at action point.
Yeah. It was a bloody fight.
I was only like 11 at the time. And Roy Scheider breaks this guy's back with his knee.
There's a bit of a crunch, isn't there?
Yeah, you don't normally get that on BBC One in 1981. You know, it's, oh my God, So, I watched the movie and I'm thinking, oh my God, I need to see this next time it's on, which would have been 18 months later, because there was no video recorders and all that stuff. And it's always remained a favourite, of me, and I watch it pretty much every couple of years. Ben, as he usually does in things like this, has written copious notes. Ben, can you just go back to the beginning of your notes? Because I love the fact that when Ben does a movie review, he has observations of some of the most mundane things or things we might have missed. Just go right back to the beginning, mate. Is there anything that you want to bring up from right from the start of the movie?
I mean, not to reiterate or duplicate myself, I've got marathon training stopwatch down pants ? I can't stress enough that's how stupid an idea that is. A variety of different reasons.
But what's the thing about the hoodie you said as well?
It's too hot. He'd be far too hot in that. There's no, wickable materials. You've got to wick that sweat away. But the thing is, anytime you watch any sort of like vintage running material, you just think this is a chafing fucking nightmare. None of these people are coming back with any nipples.
Yeah, didn't Rocky have a big hoodie on as well?
He had a huge hoodie.
But he was probably making weight. He's trying to sweat it out. He wasn't doing 26.2 miles. If you did, you'd die.
Enlighten me, guys. When did sort of jogging and running become like a pastime?
Well, I didn't think it was as early as the 70s. I thought it was more like an 80s, 90s thing. But I think maybe in the UK, actually.
It's had a massive explosion of interest. I mean, it continues to do so, even in the time that I've been involved in it probably, or was maybe the last sort of 12, 13 years. And I was probably on one wave of, enthusiasm then. And there's probably been a couple before that. But I think, I did the Great North Run in 99. And I think there was about 28,000 people did it then. I did it last year and it was over 60,000, I think. So you can see how the interest has peaked. But you go back to you know, sort of the mid-80s, people who did things like that, it was proper runners, you know, like, you know,
yeah.
You know, and I would say it began to become a much more fashionable hobby in probably in the 90s, late 90s.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, you know, serious amateurs who did this kind of crap.
First London Marathon was early 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, 82, 83, something like that.
And it was the 40th anniversary of the Great North Run 2 years ago. So.
So, early 80s, it wasn't something that was commonly done.
And usually fads like that are America first, then come over to Europe and the UK. So, yeah, it makes sense.
Sort of leading into the Jane Fonda and the exercise stuff and all that thing in the early 80s.
Olivia Newton-John.
Let's get physical, absolutely. okay, so Ben's picked up on stopwatch down the crotch. you know where he's running, actually? You know, in Central Park?
Mm-hmm.
At that reservoir.
Yeah. Mm.
It's the Jackie Kennedy reservoir.
The thing that surprised me about that was the huge wire fence around it.
Yeah.
It's just like such a beautiful park and lake.
It's a private part of the park.
And they put that horrible blooming 10-foot tall fence around it.
It's like a proper reservoir for, I don't know, public water or whatever. And it's called the Jackie Kennedy Reservoir. You know, JFK got an airport, she got a reservoir.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't do anything, did she, particularly?
I was going to say, did she shoot to fame?
They use, as an aside, they use the exact same scene in Ghostbusters 2 as well.
Do you know what? I noticed some of the buildings at the background, and I'm thinking, do you know what?
That was
Ghostbusters territory.
There's a scene in Ghostbusters 2 where they catch a running ghost, and it's an homage to Marathon Man. And they park against that big fence.
Yeah, they sort of set it up as well, don't they? Because there's the bit where he runs past the, I don't know, the water filtration building or whatever it may be.
The pump house, I think.
Pump house or something. And the guy sort of says to him, oh, your best time or whatever, and he starts chasing. And then when he meets, is it Marta Keller or whatever it is, the girlfriend, she's there with the stopwatch timing him, and she's sitting outside that building as well. And that's where, like, you know, the end of the movie ends up. Ben, read just your next note, mate, because I'm relying on you to run this forward, mate, because some of the stuff Ben writes, it absolutely cracks me up when he...
We cut across to, I've got tin box past, move that heap. So that must be into the city scene when the guy emerges from the bank and he passes the tin of... We don't know what's in the tin at this point, do we? It's just a tin.
It's a very small tin, and
the tin is Band-Aids, isn't it?
And I thought at that point it's diamonds, right?
Okay.
And all the way through the film, I'm thinking they're arguing about and killing people about this tiny little tin full of diamonds.
Okay.
Obviously, not knowing the end, when there might be a few more, and I'm thinking this film doesn't make sense. This is like maximum of like 100 grand's worth of diamonds, and people are dying left, right, and centre. I was wrong.
Yes, there's more tins where that tin came from.
And this is Laurence Olivier's brother, isn't it? We're talking about here.
Yes, that's the one that dies in the car crash.
He's in New York. Laurence Olivier is somewhere in South America.
Uruguay, I think, isn't it?
Uruguay,
yeah.
And Roy Scheider is in
Paris.
With his own tin as well, actually.
Yes, he's got a tin.
Yeah, the same tin. That's where it probably gets confusing, because it's the same tin.
Exactly. Maybe it was sponsored by Band-Aid. Have you found yourself using more plasters since you've watched it? That's what I mean. Has their ploy worked?
Certainly not gone to the dentist as much.
See, they would have tied it up if Dustin Hoffman lifted up his shirt and he plastered his nipples. You know, then and it all comes full circle and starts to make some sense.
I love the fact that everybody's focus is completely different in this movie. You know? Ben is so worried about Dustin Hoffman's nipples. And
I tell you, if you'd seen what I'd seen, you'd be worried as well.
What's your next note, mate? God, I'm going to run with Ben throughout this whole review. Come on, Ben.
There's some Nazi bastard ramming, and a chase and a fuel truck crash, yeah, which we've talked about.
The obvious fuel truck just appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah. I did read a bit more into it. The reason there were so many Jewish out and about is it was a holiday. It was a Jewish
Yom Kippur.
Holiday.
Yom Kippur. Yeah. Yep, they did say that.
So I did sort of look at it and think, why is there's like a Jewish celebration here and there's more Jewish down there? And I'm thinking, okay, there's always parts in big cities that are predominantly Jewish. But it was just, there were so many of them. And as you said, they all just stood there and looked and as if it was an everyday occurrence.
Can't move for it.
Even when the car crashed into the truck, nobody actually ran as such. Did they? They sort of like, heads were turning almost. All right, it's fucked up their wedding. But nobody actually sort of like dived in to do anything. Yeah, it's bizarre. Oh, yeah, okay. Your next note, Ben, what have we got next?
We're back with Morgan Freeman racing a dog temporarily.
Morgan Freeman.
What have I got? I can't even remember anymore.
Morgan Freeman?
No, I've got Morgan Freeman. It says, I'm going to explain this. I'm not drinking. It says, but it looks like Morgan.
Right, so
I've got Morgan Freeman on the mind. Who hasn't? Imagine if he'd been in it, though. Imagine if he'd been running alongside him.
So Morgan Freeman is in Central Park, yeah?
Yeah, it's with Dustin Hoffman, who's running. Yeah. It's temporarily harassed by a dog.
Keep that dog on a leash, yes.
Yeah. Which happens. I've been bitten several times by dogs when out running. So
Ben's notes are all going to be related to the running sequences and just how unrealistic all this shit, or how realistic.
No, that's fair.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
I think what that scene does is as well, though, it's typical of sort of gritty 70s feel of these kind of films, you know, even something that, you know, on the face of it, he's out, he's doing something not pleasurable because he's working hard. But even then it becomes sort of grimy and injured. And, you know, you get that sort of getting under your fingernails feeling that these films in particular are really good at.
At this point in the movie, right, Dustin Hoffman, we're getting a good impression of Dustin Hoffman's life. And how old do you think Dustin Hoffman is supposed to be in this film?
He's obviously at uni he's doing a postgraduate or something like that.
PhD, so, yeah.
Yeah, he's got to be 23, 24, something along those lines.
But does he look a lot older than 23?
Yeah, he looks like well into his 30s.
He's 37, I think, wasn't he? Something like 37, 38 in reality. But yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, not that much older, similar age to Roy Scheider, absolutely.
Wow. Yeah.
And that always froze me, because it's never resolved. It's never actually said how old Dustin Hoffman is. I tried to work it out, because when it went to the flashback of his father shooting himself in the 50s or whatever, and he said he was 6 years old, I think he was.
Yeah,
so that was a reference to him being six.
Yeah, so
that would make him about
20
26.
Years from, 26,
But he looks a little bit older than 26,
I think that's fair. I mean, and I think but the one thing it does help, though, is his nickname, The Creep, which his neighbours have given him.
I love that gang of guys. You're not supposed to, but I love that. Oh, Creep. and it works in his favour.
Later on.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got the dog, Ben. What have we got next?
Well, he gets home. He tries to race the another marathon trainer, and he can't do it. So we get this sort of feeling that he's, you know, despite the fact he's training for a marathon, he's a little way off yet. But then he goes home when he gets abused by his neighbours on the way, as they refer to him, as the creep. But we see he's quite obsessive about marathon times. He writes them all on a clipboard inside. So we get the sort of the understanding that he's a really focused guy. Yep. You know, he's got something that he's working towards, and he's maybe even to the point of being, you know, slightly on the spectrum. Is that fair to say? You know, he's obviously obsessive about these things, which I think is maybe alluded to. But yeah, but then we're immediately over in France with Roy Scheider, not knowing what the fuck's going on. So lots of bicycles and well, the, you know.
Well, it goes from Dustin Hoffman coming home, writing down his like time for the day
on
the clipboard, getting into the bath, and then seeing the news clip about the car crash.
Yeah.
Because he witnesses the car crash as he runs through Central Park because he sees the flames. So he then watches that on the TV. And as Ben says, we then go to Paris and we see Roy Scheider wrapping up a box of chocolates.
With the Band-Aid tin in.
Band-Aid tin. Yeah, I was going to say half a box of chocolates. It's the
same Band-Aid tin that we've seen earlier. So we're thinking, okay, is that, how the hell was that got from New York? Or is it the same Band-Aid? You start, you know, and I can see why Paul was getting confused.
Yeah, don't take much.
And thinking back, for somebody that's seen this film over 10 times, I still don't know what's going on at this point, actually, now when you think about it. Because it was all to do with Roy Scheider works for some government agency, we're assuming, yeah?
Yeah, it's something between the FBI and the CIA. It's called
the Division.
So
that's what he calls it late on. That's when it's explained to Dustin Hoffman.
But at this point, we don't even know at this point that Laurence Olivier's brother is some sort of link to all of this in New York, because he's the only one that's got access to the diamonds in the safe deposit box.
Yes, and they think that his brother is dead, but they're not sure.
They don't know if Laurence Olivier is alive or not.
Yeah. Right.
So what's in the tin that goes in?
Band-Aids.
Yeah. Well, what's in the tin? I'm assuming it's diamonds.
Yeah.
Military secrets.
Who knows?
Microfilms.
And then we get to this really bizarre scene where he goes into the antique dealer's shop.
Mm.
And there's this guy eating his lunch desk, which is like, you know, French bread and wine, basically. An American tourist is haggling over some artifact or something.
Yeah, tells him to go away in no uncertain terms.
And he's somehow linked to... Again, I don't know how this all works out.
I think what they're retrospectively, after having seen it, what they're going back to is that Schneider is some courier for whatever he's carrying, probably diamonds. Mm. The antiques dealer is a fence or a transporter for these diamonds. So I think that's where they all link in.
But I get the impression that all the diamonds are in this safe deposit box in New York.
I don't think these diamonds that he's carrying are linked in particularly with the other diamonds. Yeah, there's a lot of diamonds in the world, apparently.
And then you get Squeaky Pran coming along.
Following him with his... That's like something out of blooming Al Capone's era. I expect him to pull a Tommy gun from the pram.
And it's also it's a terrible bomb.
Push it down the stairs at Grand Central Station. Or is that a different film?
Your favourite movie. As Ben points out, it's a bomb that blows up a dustbin.
Yeah, certainly. It doesn't
do anything, does it?
It reminded me of something I was reading this week, actually, because through work we have access to these newspaper archives, and I use them for a variety of different reasons, and then I occasionally have to do some legitimate work as well. But there was an article, it alludes to something you'll have heard of, but I hadn't ever heard of it reported in quite this way. So, you know, the incident where an attempted assassination of Hitler, where someone put a bomb under his map table and it went off. And the people, obviously, as you can imagine, the very important people around the table. Anyway, it blew off. But the nature of the table, it was a heavy table. Explosion went out underneath and all it really did was blow their trousers off. According to the newspaper report, there's a scene where Mussolini comes in and none of them are wearing trousers, and Hitler has to quickly explain, "Look, there was a bomb to blow my trousers off." That made me think of this with this terrible bomb.
Are you sure that was a newspaper report or an episode of Hello, Hello?
The headline for the article was genuinely "Hitler loses his pants." I'm not even making this up. I could send you a copy of it.
Is that how he lost a ball as well?
Who knows? That might be the incident.
So we're at the point of this movie where nobody knows what's going on.
No.
Yeah, we're still none the wiser here. There's just
not even Roy Scheider. He doesn't.
Scheider, who should have known because he fought a shark the year before. And, you know, at this point, Paul, first time watch, nothing is making sense.
No, and to be honest, if I hadn't have been watching this to review it, that's about the time I would have probably turned this film off.
Not this shade.
Yeah, I was like. Who the heck wrote this shit? I'm going to watch blooming, I don't know, Richard Osman's House of Games or something silly like that.
Where do we go from here? What happened after the bomb then? So
we're back to...
back to Dustin Hoffman, doesn't it, at this point?
And we find out what he's up to, yeah. He's doing his PhD in tyranny. He's writing his thesis or his dissertation on tyranny.
Yes, he meets the lecturer that knew his father.
Yeah, but he's purposely missed out the McCarthy era.
Because he killed his father.
He says he's going to mention it or something. Yeah. He says it's vitally important to your dissertation because are you doing this because your father was...
And obviously the teacher picks him out purposely, gets him to stay behind because he knows he's really good.
Because he knew the answer to the Tennyson question as well, wasn't he?
He obviously knows he's an intelligent man.
He's also worried that he's living his father's life rather than his own life. I think that's a trait that comes up several times. I think his brother mentions it later on as well, saying, don't seek to just effectively regenerate our dad's life, have your own life, you know. And I haven't read the book, but I suspect that was a pretty strong theme throughout.
Yeah, I think the teacher says, you could have gone to a dozen other colleges. You know, why have you chosen this one? This is the one your father went to. And then Scheider mentions it later.
Yeah, he says, come with me to Washington and
study there. You know, he's adamant that he wants to study at that particular college, doesn't he? Because that was where his father was. We get... And again, this is the point in these sort of university scenes where it is so evident that Dustin Hoffman is not 18 years old here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's fair to say that PhD students can be a range of ages, but also the way in which it's written, there's maybe a certain naivety of youth apparent in his character. And, you know, he's touching middle age at this point. Yeah. You know, so it's not not helped.
It just makes it a bit confusing to actually understand what age Dustin Hoffman is supposed to be.
I think Americans quite often do this in films. They'll have...
Well, the first thing that came to mind was It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, where he starts the film as a fucking 17-year-old and finishes off as a 47-year-old or something like that. And he was 45 at the time or something, you know.
Yeah, they quite often play characters many years below or above.
Yeah. So where do we go from the university and from the bomb?
Back to France, to the opera, where...
Opera, right, okay.
Yeah, I've forgotten about the opera.
Where a murder has occurred.
He goes into the wrong box to start with, or he's let into the wrong box, isn't he, by the woman there at the top of the stairs?
Yes.
And did you think that at the beginning that guy was dead? Not the second one, the first one when he goes into the first box. So, what's going on here? This guy is like really sitting still.
He's bored shitless from the opera, it would appear.
Yeah. And then he goes to see whatever he says to him. And it's, I'm in the wrong box. So he goes to the next box. And there's the guy from the antique shop with his throat slit.
Yes. Very well.
Yeah, that was a very bad special effect. Yes, actually, very bad makeup on that. And now Paul's even more confused at this point because he's just getting really...
I'm losing the will to live at this point.
Ben's still with it. Ben's expecting more running. He's like, don't fight. Yeah. It's marathon, man. It's going to be some more running somewhere.
Surely. It's going to have a payoff at some point. As you say, he does have to run away from something. I guess that's all you get.
So we must flash back to the Swiss student, the girlfriend, at some point now, aren't we? We're there? Is this before?
I don't know, because I think if we do, I've missed that bit out because I was not...
Yeah, I'm sure he meets
What have you got next
Elsa
on your notes? He meets Elsa, obviously, before Roy Scheider goes back to New York.
Yeah, because he's had the interaction with her at the library, and they've sort of flirted a little.
And that was the other thing as well. In the library, let's say this is the next point. He's obviously taken an interest in Elsa, who's sitting opposite him in the library. There's this whole thing about her flirting with him and asking him some sort of question. And does he actually hide the book? I never saw the bit where he hides the book.
I didn't see it. I didn't pay attention to that. I know I thought she just outrightly left the
just
book.
Walked off.
She walked off and didn't clear her table, which was books on it.
But he catches up with her and says, I do apologise, I deliberately hid your book with your name and address in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, yeah, I think she did leave it, because that would make sense as to, you know, later on, and it was, oh, she's been planted there to attract his attention. Yeah. So the fact that she's left that hanging around for him is, would make sense. But yes, again, it is a slightly confusing element of the screenplay for him to say, oh, I stole it. When it, yeah. Did he, as you say, why, and why, if he didn't, why would he say that other than it being a terrible chattel line?
Or to lessen her embarrassment about actually leaving it there. He's well, making up that lie.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can see why they call him the creep then, can't you?
Absolutely. What a fucking dirtbag. Yeah.
He does come across as a bit of a sex offender, actually, when, you know, when he's pursuing her relentlessly and she's like, goodbye. Oh, no, but I'll just say no goodbye. Yeah.
Pushes his way through the door, you know, literally just like lets himself into the block of flats, you know.
Yeah, I just think
now wrong on that.
We've all been there, Paul. Yeah. Yeah.
What, prison?
So it must be at this point we get to. I know we said we weren't going to do this chronologically and working through
this,
but I think we have to. We must be at the point back in Paris now in the hotel room.
It was actually, it was the other way around, actually. So basically, Roy Schneider goes from doing what push-ups in his Y-fronts to breaking an Asian assassin's neck within the space of about 2 minutes. Yeah.
Right. Let rewind slightly.
When to the Y-fronts.
No, when we see Roy Schneider in the hotel room originally, this guy comes in with a suit.
Oh, yeah, he does, yeah. And, he's
really... and he says, oh, I'm sorry, monsieur, it's the wrong room, or whatever, and leaves the door open.
Yes.
But a whole day passes in between it. And we see the Chinese guy watching him from the restaurant or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
But the Chinese guy is then hiding in the wardrobe. At this point,
mm-hmm.
there's something missing here, something that's been added.
He's watching for a chink in the door.
I was going to say something else, but I'm not going to, in case you include it.
As Charlie would say, is that the sequel to The Indian in the Cupboard? But,
I was going to say, you're absolutely certain it's the same man.
But it is. Now, the guy that comes in the suit obviously is the concierge or whatever he is. The Asian guy that has got the cheese wire is watching Roy Scheider in the restaurant before. He's not been hiding in the cupboard for 24 hours or 12 hours or whatever it may be. I can't see what the point of that guy coming in with the suit, leaving the door open.
Because it was very purposeful, wasn't it?
Mm. Well, maybe he went in and saw, is the cupboard big enough for me to fit in later? You know, just scoped it out.
But it's not that guy. It's a different guy.
But I'm just saying, in the intervening period of time, what we didn't see after that was, you know, he snuck in. Oh, yeah, I can fit in that cupboard later. Snuck back out again. I said, oh, yeah. Yeah. Maybe they were brothers. I don't know. There was...
The more I review this, and this is one of my favourite movies of all time, guys, I'm learning to actually not like this film.
Tends to go one of two ways.
Yeah, there's so much wrong with this film. So we get, in my mind, the classic scene of Roy Scheider fighting a guy with a bit of cheese wire in front of some net curtains, being watched by a guy on a balcony in a wheelchair.
Yes, throwing his arms about.
Meanwhile, there's a strike going on in Paris.
Yeah,
the dustmen are striking. It's causing a great big like commotion downstairs. You know,
it's like a remake of Rear Window set in Paris during a bin man strike.
It's a rubbish remake.
Hey, very good. Yes.
But I do like that scene. Apart from the fact that Paul mentioned he thinks that there is some like massive hand thing going on with Roy Scheider.
Watch that again and pay attention to the back of his hand.
But that whole sequence of, you know, just him breaking his back and calling in for, is it not removals, is it? What does he call for?
Clean up.
I've got this.
I don't know.
It is removals. That's what he asked.
Removals. For. Yeah, a bit like a Nikita, that sort of thing, isn't it? Or. Yeah.
John Leon,
you know.
Yeah.
That's...
marathon man. Much has been said about Sir Laurence Olivier, and that he was at a stage in his life that, in the interest of his family, he wanted to provide for them. Was it that, or what? What was it like working with him at that stage in his life and the genius he brought to acting?
I think the most memorable thing about Marathon Man was that I knew Laurence Olivier. I had met him at the National Theatre, and he had become very ill and wasn't really able to work. Mm-hmm. He did one or two days for Herb Ross in a film about Sherlock Holmes. As he said, "My dear boy, I did it just to run, to try it out, to see if the engine was still running." And he came to us when I first talked to him about doing it. He had a very high-pitched voice because his muscles were all affected. And I had to go through the whole script in London to say, "Now, this is the moment I want you to do this," and you run to the tack. "Can't run, dear boy, could only walk fast." But this voice was so high, and when he came, he was much better when he started here in New York. And the wonderful thing about the film was to see him get better every day he worked.
As if what, energy flowed into his body?
Yes, as if the old pro was
any doubt in your mind that he, I mean, would you make the critical judgment he's the best actor?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that's he was a wonderful theatrical actor. Yeah. He gave some very good and some pretty bad performances on film, but he was assumed to be the greatest actor.
Yeah, I mean,
and directors, I think, were sometimes frightened to say anything to him.
So they let him. They wouldn't direct him.
No, and he said, "Please tell me, dear boy, tell me," and I would see him going over the top, and I thought...
Yeah, but there's a great story, which I know you've heard 1,000 times, about Hoffman.
Oh, yes.
Tell me this story. The story is that, and you pick it up, Hoffman had gone for 3 days without sleep because he wanted to look, feel, act this wonderful moment with Olivier. Pick up the story.
It was the dental scene.
Yes, right.
And Olivier had carefully practiced saying, "Is it safe?" umpteen different ways. I didn't really have to direct him. He had worked it out to the T. And Hoffman needed other means to look out of it. So he sat in his chair and he was sort of... every time Olivier came near him, the pupils didn't. Nothing came out of the eyes. And when I saw the rushes, I knew that we had to reshoot all his close-ups. And Olivier then said to me, I said, "Larry, I'm sorry, we've got to reshoot his stuff." And he said, "Oh, why doesn't he just act?" But it was very interesting working with the two of them, because Dustin's a wonderful
brilliant actor,
right. And a great improviser. Right. And Olivier was of an age where, and of a tradition, where he learned the lines and he didn't want to go away from them.
It's interesting how stories like this sort of get around. I mean, the story I'd always heard, the punchline was, "My boy, have you tried acting?"
Yes, I have.
Okay, guys, we must be at the point where Laurence Olivier is somewhere in South America by now, what?
Yeah, he's looking out of a window at wet butterflies at this point.
Is that a euphemism?
Explain that. What's that got anything to do with?
What? All I got was it rains in Uruguay before the butterflies have got a chance to go wherever butterflies go when it rains, because they're getting buried. You know, it's quite a sad sight of wet butterfly. No one wants that.
Do you reckon they come indoors? Like, you know, you get a big, like, fly in the summer that buzzes round, or a blue bottle or something that just... And the butterflies just come indoors.
I must have fallen asleep at this point.
You miss the butterflies.
I have no recollection of Uruguay and wet butterflies.
So there's a scene where Laurence Olivier is in this... It's like a hut on the river, isn't it, Ben? And he's surrounded by skulls and teeth.
Yes, it's like a compound, isn't it? It reminds me of like a drug dealer's compound. And
Do you reckon he's under arrest at this point? Because
I think he's in hiding. But I know what you mean, because he has to sneak out dressed as his mother or whatever it is.
Do you think I might have seen a different cut of this film?
No, you've just missed this scene. Then
I've shut my eyes.
Right. Yeah. Basically, we're in South America on some sort of like river, the Amazon, wherever it may be. There's this hut on the river, and Laurence Olivier's there with a full head of hair.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so Ben, he's missed this bit, Ben, right? Okay.
This is quite important. The fact that he had a full head of hair as well.
And this boat comes up to this hut with a woman in a shawl carrying washing, basically his laundered shirts.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. It's coming back to me.
Yep. She goes in, she puts the shirts in his drawer.
Yes.
He's got the newspaper. We can see the newspaper of the death of his brother.
Yep. Got this now.
There's lots of like glass cabinets with animal skulls with teeth, which gives us an indication.
Didn't pay attention to that.
Dentistry background. And then he starts clipping his hair. Is this the point where he clips his hair? He does, doesn't he? He clips it, but he doesn't shave it.
No, he just gives himself a rough cut to finish the job on the plane later.
On the plane.
That's it. I remember it in the bathroom on the plane where he's shaving his.
It wasn't flying in the 1970s. It's terrific. And you could have like a pipe. Then you could just like go off into the box and pull your Remington off your hair, and no one's even going to like bat an eyelid or accuse you of being a shoe bomber or anything.
Listen, on the plane, they're handing people their overcoats as well and things like that. They've even got off.
It's like a cloakroom.
What on earth is going on?
I know, it's a more civilized time, I think it's fair to say.
For the first time in 30 plus years of watching this movie, I suddenly realised, why is he sneaking away in disguise from the compound? Why? He's not under arrest? Who's he trying to hide from?
Well, he's really paranoid, isn't he? I mean, the whole end of the film is about the fact that he's paranoid that he's going to get robbed when he's taking his diamond. So I read it as...
Recognised.
He's effectively in some kind of like, you know, like drug dealer's compound, you know, like you could live your life happily, but you can't ever go out of the little thing that you've got. But he's worried that if someone spots him leaving, it's more rather than they're going to like shoot him or anything, it's who are they going to tell? Are they going to, you know, say, he's on his way? So he's trying to sneak out because the agent people are meant to be sort of these, as you say, they're these sort of men in black type. You know, beyond the reach of the law type people, and you know, you never know who their agents might be. Man in jungle holding AK-47 number 3.
So what he thinks, you know, sort of like, I don't know, what's his name, Bruce Ismay out of Titanic, disguised as a woman on the lifeboat.
Gene Hackman at the end of The Birdcage.
And then we see him a little bit later on the plane, as we say, with a Remington, whatever, Master Shave, shaving a bald patch on his head.
Yeah.
I don't know how effective this is going to be, you know. To be honest, the disguise probably would have been more effective if he had kept his dark hair.
Yeah.
And dark moustache. Or even shaved his head
completely so he didn't still have this white band of hair going round, as he was known as the White Eagle.
He was known as the White Angel.
He could have dyed it blonde like Bruce Willis in The Jackal. That would have been
nice,
wouldn't it?
So, okay, Laurence Olivier has fled South America at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile... Where are we in New York? Roy Scheider has come back to New York to see Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, he's not just knocked on the door. He's broken in and then attacked his brother, who obviously shits himself, but then gets over it very quickly. It's like, oh, someone's just broken in, scared to shit. I mean, oh, it's you. I'm okay now. And throws him a clean sheet to sleep on. I don't know. I didn't even see a sofa in there. I don't know what he was going to put a sheet on.
On the bed that Dustin Hoffman... the flashlight under the bed.
Mm.
Yeah, when Dustin Hoffman hears... Not flashlight. What movie were you watching?
Different kind of marathon man.
Snickers woman.
apparently, Dustin Hoffman said to John Schlesinger that he didn't want to do the bit where he pulls a flashlight from under the mattress. He said because it made him look cowardly, and he really objected to that. But John Schlesinger said, no, if you look at this from a cinematographer's point of view, we're going to get a great shot of like being dark and the beam of the light going round, and you don't see Roy Scheider, do you? You see like ET, does it, where a book goes over.
Yeah. It's paranormal activity.
Yeah.
There was a couple of bits in this where it was, I appreciate they wanted to do it in silhouette or whatever. There was a couple of bits in this where it was just too dark to know what the hell was going on.
Oh, you had some dark moments.
Yeah.
You sound like my dad. That's one of my dad's complaints back in the day. Yeah, I don't know why they made them so dark. Like, yes. You know, I just got to see what's going on. He never talked like that, by the way. That's just
there's a fight scene going on, and it's so dark you can't tell who the heck is in there, hitting who, doing what. And it's just... you could have just put a sound effect on it and just left it black and, yeah, just left it to your imagination.
So Dustin Hoffman thinks that Roy Scheider is in the oil industry.
Yes.
Yeah.
The oil industry.
Oil man.
Yeah, his brother's come back and he's broke his bottle. He's broke his, cut his hand on a bottle of Chablis or something, he said. Mm. And he's got this really decent wine that he pours out into a really scuzzy glass.
Yeah, a pint glass that needed a wash, definitely.
But this bit, that's a great scene. That is like a real great indication of the love between the two brothers that, you know.
I think that's the first time you realise they're brothers.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been no indication of this at all. It's probably the first point where the story actually links together. All these different strands are actually coming together somewhere.
Yeah, because you knew Schneider wasn't who he was telling Hoffman he was. So you knew there was some difference there. You, as much as you didn't know what Schneider had done, you knew he was like somewhere in the spy business.
Mm. Yeah.
So, no, that's
Am I right now that Scheider sets up a meeting with Olivier as he comes through?
Yeah.
They go for dinner first, don't they? So he takes his brother and the young who in a previous scene is now we know involved in a full on sexual relationship with Dustin Hoffman. I think, which again actually does his character no favors because he comes across as a little, I don't know, little Minuteman. a pawing repetitive Minuteman. so they all go out for lunch to a fancy restaurant where
bow tie on a polo shirt.
Yeah, but yeah, badly. Not that you can do that well, in fairness.
The Scheider's immediately suspicious of her because
he's
a spy, isn't he? He knows his shit.
Yeah, absolutely. But he just has these sneaky like roundabout questions to find out where she was. You know,
yeah, you're not really French, are you? Or Swiss,
the mountain. The reason behind the fact she was lying is because she is actually German. Is this
yes?
Right?
She's yes, German. That's right. German. Yeah,
but she was embarrassed to say she was German.
Who wouldn't be?
She never really gives an explanation. She just runs off.
Yeah. So why is she? This is the bit again. Like for the first time in 30
years. Oh, because she was only there. He thought she was only there to get a green card to get
married. Work permit. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but in actuality, she's actually there to seduce Minuteman. Yeah. It's quite pleasing because Minuteman and Marathon Man obviously interchangeable.
Oh, is that like? You know, Fast and Furious has worked his way up to Fast X now. You know, so Minuteman might have been the first one that's worked his way up to Marathon.
Yeah. I don't want to watch the intervening films, if that's all right.
No, well, Vin Diesel wasn't in
there. Fast and Not So Furious.
So we get this meeting, this wonderful sort of fountain thing in New York.
Oh, what, that really horrible red sort of square bit of modern art type thing.
You didn't like that, Paul.
It's very 70s, yeah.
What have you got against culture, Paul?
Yeah. Modern art,
lots.
This is where we find out what this bracelet thing was that Olivier snapped on his wrist.
Because
we see him snap this on before he leaves on the boat.
The ultimate spy dagger up the sleeve.
Yeah, which they didn't spot at the airport.
Yeah. In the X-ray machine. Obviously, no metal
detector. What X-ray machine?
Yeah.
We've already seen it's like a half-assed airways. No one cares.
Are you carrying any weapons? No. I'll go through then.
Yes. No, you see. Yes. Oh, okay. Whatever.
So, yeah, he's got this lovely sort of James Bond type, you know, dagger device that would have been in a boot in 1962, but it's on his wrist in 76. And he guts Scheider like a fish. Or we get that scene before where Scheider goes through, after the opera, where he goes through the arches and the football, the bounces.
Bouncing football. Yeah, yeah. Which again, I was hoping was going to blow up the first time I saw it. I thought it was going to be a football.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense at all, because what he's done, he's met with William Devane in the restaurant and this other woman who's gone off. And then when they meet after the, whatever it is, the opera, they're meeting this sort of colonnade thing.
Mm.
And he says to the woman, keep walking, we've been found out.
It's not safe.
It's not, yeah, yeah, it's not Jesus. Safe, exactly. Yeah. She disappears off to wherever. And then this football bounces across. Any ideas on this?
I think that's just the director being a bit.
Is it the fact that somebody's out there, we're watching you as a football to let you know we're watching you?
It's Europe. There's always a football somewhere.
Yeah.
But this is in New York. This is back in New York, I think. Or is
No, that's the opera, because it's when he comes out of the opera hat with his mate having been sliced and diced. It's then when the football appears. So that's when he gets the
in Paris, isn't it? Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've gone back to Paris. Okay, so by now Roy Scheider's lying in a pool of blood at this fountain that Paul doesn't particularly like.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Ghastly.
A ghastly fountain that Paul doesn't like. Where do we go from here? What happened after that?
But he just crawls to Dustin Hoffman's apartment, doesn't he?
He's dead, basically, by this fountain, and somehow manages to crawl however many miles it is to his apartment, rather than go to a hospital, which was probably nearer, to whisper something in his ear that no one can hear, and then promptly dies a second later.
Okay, cool, Ben.
I know why this scene makes no sense as well, though, because there's a cut scene from earlier in the film. In the cut scene earlier in the film, with it underscores the fact that Roy Scheider is the spy, which would also have helped the film, because we really could have done with that information very early on. He meets a fellow assassin or a fellow spy in an airport, and that colleague, or whatever you want to call them, is then killed by yet another set of baddies. And Roy Scheider has a fight with them. And at that point decides, when he sees what's happened to his mate, that effectively he knows he's going to end up going the same way. And he's determined, if he ever gets killed like that, he wants to be in the arms of someone who knows and loves him. And that's why when he gets stabbed, he finds superhuman strength to go back to his brother, just to be with him. Not because he's got anything to whisper into his ear about diamonds or Nazis or knives up sleeves.
That would have been a decent helpful bit of information to
would
have.
Would have been helpful, wouldn't it? Yeah, I always think that might have ironed out a few kinks.
It would have done, but it would have just prolonged your agony even more,
wouldn't
it?
It
would have dragged it out another 20 minutes. Okay, so he's died on Dustin Hoffman's carpet.
But I've got a question about this, right?
Yes.
Because the next we cut and the police are there, and there's a chalk outline, or it's a figure masking tape outline. Have they taped round him as he's like? Yep. Have they lifted up his body to put some tape down?
No, nope,
it was a really tight outline. It wasn't. It just was. Tight. Yeah, it was like under his sort of.
It was. It was right under.
Yeah.
His masking tape's never going to stick in that pool of blood.
I think accuracy was the key word here. They wanted it so precise.
There's a bit that you're going to mention next that I'm going to rip to shreds. So after Janeway questions him.
William Devane, yeah.
Yeah. And leaves, and then Hoffman tries to go back to sleep. Mm. Or no, goes to have a bath, doesn't he?
Yes.
And then there's a noise in his apartment and he barricades himself in the bathroom by locking the door with that simple latch that could have been kicked in with one swift kick.
This is the most brilliant 20 minutes of any movie ever coming up.
So a blade comes through the crack in the door. Yes.
Crowbar.
Yeah. And is trying to force the door open. And I actually rewound this because the first time I saw it, I was like,
The wall moved.
Yeah. Not the door. The door frame, but the fucking wall moves.
It's a cheap room.
It's not a cheap room. It's a fucking cheap set. Literally, you can see him forcing the blade at an angle, and you expect the frame or the door to move, but no, the whole wall shuffles to the side.
Cheap New York brownstone slab.
Or some amazing blade made of blooming something super strong. It's like watching Prisoner Cell Block H all over again.
So the tension was sort of lost for you.
Yeah, I literally thought, did I just see that? I rewound it and I went, yes, the wall is moving. And then he decides to break a window and shout out of it rather than break a window and crawl through it. It was not the best scene.
What else would you have done? I mean, was there any other option for him? He's stuck in a bathroom that he can't get out the window.
He could have.
He's
got towels in there. You break the glass, you put the towel down, you crawl out.
Okay. What if he lives on the fifth floor?
Yeah.
There's a fire escape. It's bloody New York. There's always a fire escape.
Out the bathroom window.
Yeah, not necessarily, is it?
It's always a fire escape.
He's not fucking Spider-Man.
So he does, you know, the only thing that's open to him, which is open the door and run like fuck through his own apartment. And of course, he gets captured by the two. That was the point. These two guys, they get him. They're the two guys that mugged.
Yeah, mugged him in the park.
In Central Park.
Yeah. Who gets mugged in the park by two guys in suits?
They make a point of that.
Yeah, it's just like something wrong there.
Civilized mugging for a civilized age. Yeah.
The guy on the right, the older guy, was one of the baddies in one of the very early James Bonds. Goldfinger, I think it might have been. He makes appearances in a couple of James Bond movies as a bad guy. The next scene must be him strapped to the chair.
Yeah, it is. Dental work,
right. Ben must have notes on this. I want to hear what Ben's written down while he was watching this, because this is always a great insight into any movie, is what Ben writes at that particular time.
Okay, I've got tied to chair. Is it safe? Is what fucking safe? Is what I've got written down. Because I think that is one of the great sort of things about this film. Is it safe? It's never really explained exactly what that means.
Right, yeah. The question, we don't know what the answer is. And we've seen what's been going on for the last hour or so. So
we don't know what the fuck's going on.
We've got no idea. But is it safe for what? Is it safe for me to do this? Is it safe for that?
I think you do, as the film goes on, you do get the impression, is it safe for him to go and collect
from the bank, safety deposit box? Yeah, that's the thing I think it is. Is it safe for me to go and get the diamonds? Or is it?
Is it referring to... Yeah, I mean, that is obviously the most logical thing to assume. But, it, watch it the first time, you think he's alluding to Mystery Tin. Because remember, Mystery Tin at the beginning goes into the hands of someone and we never see it again. We assume it's Roy Scheider's tin and it isn't, which, or at least we don't think it is, unless there's a missing scene. Maybe it is. It is a bit of a coincidence. It's the same tin.
Is this how it works out, that the brother gets the tin from the safe deposit box, puts it in the pocket of somebody in New York that we don't see?
Yeah.
Let's assume that's Roy Scheider. Roy Scheider has got the tin. He then puts it in the chocolate box, which goes to the guy in the...
Because Roy Scheider does say he's been to New York, because he says it went straight forward.
Yeah. So that then goes to the guy that's got the antique shop.
Yeah.
Because he gives him the chocolates while he's eating his lunch in the shop. Yeah, he gives him the chocolate box.
Yeah.
Antique guy then gets killed at the opera.
Mm-hmm.
So that tin, we don't know where that's gone at this point.
We've learned nothing so far about the existence of diamonds, because that doesn't come out until the post-dental exposition car ride, when he starts telling him about diamonds and teeth and Nazis and dentists and things. You know, it's so at this point, Is It Safe could easily refer to the tin of mystery, and also the key that we see briefly in the dead man's hand as he's going up like a human candle.
It doesn't make sense.
I think I'm even more confused now than when I watched it.
No, I think you're right. I think it does mean, is it safe for me to go and collect my blood diamonds? But but at this point, who knows? It's no wonder Dustin Hoffman doesn't know. I love his answer. What he's like, no, it's safe. It's very safe. No, it's not safe. It's not safe. Brilliant.
See, that's just his way of like bluffing it out. But Paul, watching it for the first time, and you knew this scene. You're aware that it's the most famous scene in the movie. That's all you knew about the film. How'd you feel about it?
Well, as much as I love dentists, I mean, the bit you see where he first sticks the hook into his cavity is bad. But
back to you in the studio.
Yeah. But the bit where he comes back later, puts him down again, and he was like, oh no, where I've already worked on that nerve's almost dead now. I've got to find a new one. I'm going to drill into a fresh tooth. And you're like, wow. And okay, you don't see that. You see the drill and then you hear the scream afterwards. Yeah.
Did you squirm?
I don't think there's a person that could watch that without squirming, knowing that you've had a drill in your mouth at some point.
So glad that for somebody that like didn't particularly enjoy this film or seen a lot of flaws in this film, the classic scene from that movie had the desired effect.
Oh, God, yeah. It's like seeing a bloke get kicked in the nuts. Every bloke would squirm at it. It's everyone. Well, I don't think there's many people alive that love going to dentists and love the sound of a dentist drill. So to visualize someone drilling into a healthy tooth to get to the point of pain is... And this is from a man that's had 14 teeth extracted at the same time.
Oh, fucking hell, what are you, Godzilla?
I might have some not real teeth.
Yeah, but it wasn't like the guy that removed them, was it?
No, it was a Nazi.
It was a Nazi, oh, right.
It's too much gold in them.
So... Ben, from your point of view, we're at this point now where, you know, he's strapped to the chair.
Mm.
Like you said, it's a classic trope of like, you know, we're going to torture him and all this. Like, you've seen this movie, well, I don't know, 4 or 5 times possibly, you reckon?
Yeah, 3 or 4 times, yeah, probably.
How did you feel watching it this time round, that particular scene? Because I still squirmed.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you what, though, I'm 42 years old, and I was 40 before the first time I had to have any dental work done at all. Been very fortunate. So I never had a fill-in, never had a tooth out, never had an out. Yeah. But during the pandemic, I had a wisdom tooth erupt and it cracked the tooth in front of it. So I had to have them both out during the pandemic, which was, as you can imagine, fun. So I went and I had the half of the cracked tooth that puts out. Why am I talking about this? Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'll finish. Smack this at once. So I went in, I had half the cracked tooth removed and filled, the intention being that it would tide me over till things had settled down. Anyway, it was very uncomfortable. And Liz described me, my wife, as having gone grey and I needed to return to the dentist. So we went in and they took that out. And there were some complications and I had to be rushed back in the afternoon because I was bleeding slowly to death. Anyway, skirt over that. A few weeks later, my standard appointment to have the original wisdom tooth came up. So I went to the hospital again, full COVID thing, you know, everyone's like at like arm's length trying to get this tooth out because no one wants to be in the fit. And the woman had this gun effectively full of, what do you call it? Pink. Yeah, it was like firing them into my jaw. And I was like, right, great. And then was like getting in with, and I'm, it sounds like I'm making this up, but what I can best describe as a screwdriver. She's getting right in there. It was right on the nerve, like right on it. And like the tears are like running down. And she did that where if it hurts too much, put your hand up. Well, my hand was up more times than I don't know. We got down to the last. She's like, I've got one cartridge of the Novocaine left. I think maybe you should come back. I said, no, we'll see it through to its agonizing conclusion. The point, anyway, out came this tooth and it had, what did they call it? It was infected, so it had a big lump on the bottom, which is why it hadn't come out in the first place. So out came this thing, and she said, oh, yeah, that's quite impressive. And I was like, virtually passive. But the point of this being that despite the other medical issues I've had throughout my life, this was the single most painful experience of my entire life, was having that tooth out. I cried at manly tears because it hurt that much. And so watching this with that new knowledge and life experience to have enjoyed and endured, I didn't enjoy this at all.
Is this the first time you've seen it since that dental experience?
Yeah, it was, yes. And even
so it hit home.
When the hook went in the cavity, I have a new fact of exactly how that would feel.
Oh, dear. I think I enjoyed his story more than the film.
But it is like the scene that everybody knows and everybody remembers, or it's the bit that everybody talks about from this film. And it still hit home for me.
Mm.
So many times I've seen this film, and I forgot, there's that initial bit, like you said, Paul, where he's got the dental picture, and he goes in.
I thought that was it, and I was like, what is everyone talking about this film just for that, 30-second clip of him sticking something in
then he gets rescued by William Devane.
Yeah, and gets, fake rescued. Yeah. Driven away, tried to get the information out of him, goes back.
Exposition car ride.
Yeah. And then it's the drill into the tooth. And you see Dustin Hoffman later on in there, and he's got this now black mark in the middle of his tooth, which I thought was very good at indicating what had gone on, sort of thing.
It's cut as well from the original, because the test audience has hated it. The second test audience hated it and they had to cut it. This and the scene where Roy Schneider gets disemboweled, they had to heavily cut that as well, because I think there was a lot of proper gruesome detail of the action of the disemboweling. And so this was a couple of that scene and this scene were cut quite heavily, so you would have got a lot more dentistry for your book if you'd been in this test screening.
Nice. What a shame. I must get hold of that copy.
I'd love to see it, to be honest.
Yeah. It's the Colgate cut.
Yeah. Hey!
This is the point where a marathon man kicks in.
Yeah. They go to move him, don't they? And for some reason, he's got his head on the roof of the car.
Well, the car's trapped next to a wall.
Yes, and he has to get in the...
So he's sort of trapped.
Yeah, and then he just legs it and runs.
In a dressing gown. What's running in the dressing gown like, Ben? Not advised, I'd
take it. I think in given
lots
the context,
of freedom down there.
I think sort of the towelette nature of the material chafing is wherever is probably secondary consideration at this point. Given that A, he's not wearing any shoes, and B, he's got had some unneeded dental work in the past. It's probably been knocked around as well. So
he made the best of a bad job in this case.
he did all right. He'd obviously have liked some Nikes on, I think, I suspect. But the fact that he was probably about to be driven to his death, probably that would be the adrenaline boost I needed.
Yeah.
It's a PB, basically. if that's covered some ground, so the training kicks in.
Would you have been prepared to jump off like a bridge on the freeway to another sort of level of the motorway underneath? Because that's what he did, didn't he? Leapt from motorway to motorway. Fair play, absolutely.
All right, did well.
Did we get sort of like flashbacks of this
As he's running away, there is flashback to the, I think it's a Kenyan or Ethiopian marathon runner. Yeah.
And I did look this guy up, and I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but he was quite a famous marathon runner. So we get, like, whoever, he must have been his inspiration or his hero or whatever.
He has his poster on his bedroom wall, doesn't he?
Yeah, there's an Italian one on his wall as well, I think. Yeah. So we get that. And am I right that Schlesinger directed Midnight Cowboy?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's scenes in Midnight Cowboy with the flashbacks of John Voight going. Like,
I'm crossing here.
Yeah, this is when Midnight Cowboy, where John Voight flashes back to why he left Texas or wherever it was to come to New York. And it's a similar sort of thing here that he does these little flashbacks throughout the movie. Dustin Hoffman, as Ben said, runs a PB here. All the way back to wherever it is in Manhattan or the Bronx, I'm assuming, I don't know, to the street where the guys have been taunting him all the way through the movie. Ben, talk us through this, because this is an amazing scene.
Yeah, it is. I mean, first of all, he pairs the taxi driver with his Rolex watch.
Rolex watch.
Always a hefty tip, I suspect, for the taxi driver involved there. Yeah, and so he's in his dressing gown and sweaty jama bottoms now. he sneaks into the lobby of the building across the road and pushes some buttons in an attempt to summon the... is his would-be bullies, but now, you know, people he can turn to his advantage. Yeah, and eventually he manages to get one of them to let him in and says, well, basically, I want you to rob my apartment. And they're like, well, why? And he's like, well, because, you know, I need some things in there. You're welcome to have anything else that you want. There's just like a stereo and a TV, and you can have that. Yeah. And the guy, like, it's obviously, as you'd imagine, pretty suspicious. He says, well, you know, what's the catch? And he's like, it's going to be pretty dangerous. And the guy's like, well, I'm in it for the danger. And then he's like, a posse appear with their afros.
I tweak the nose of danger and laugh in the face of fear.
His eyes light up with the prospect of, a bit of adrenaline. What else would I be doing at 5 o'clock in the morning Wednesday or whatever it is?
Yeah, all the gold I can eat. Come on, bring it on.
They go, and like there's like eight of them trying to break into this apartment, and then what's his face, the agent guy, like pulls a gun and says, go on. And then they all pull guns and say, fuck off. We've got more guns than you. We're going in. Try and stop us. Yeah, I love that.
So where do we go from here? Because this is like literally now we're going into
Hoffman's chance to get his gun because he'd already phoned to arrange to meet Elsa.
Actually, Paul, you said to me this last 20 minutes was probably your favorite 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's when it started to make sense.
people started to get shot as well.
It got captivating. You knew people were after him. You knew it was like a chase down. They go to the a house in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And just before they go in, Hoffman asks Elsa, is he in there? Mm-hmm. And she's like, denies anything to start with, and then crumbles very quickly to admit that basically she's been stringing him along all this time and she is just waiting there for the rest to join. And then he sort of takes her almost like fake hostage, and waiting for the others to turn up. And then when they turn up, and he's got a gun pointing at her and pointing at them, and there's three of them, and he just lets them in the house.
Yeah. It's very polite, isn't it?
Yeah. Rather than, like, perhaps shoot one of them as a warning or something along those lines, no, I'll let these three people into a more confined space where I have less chance of getting away.
They start maliciously fiddling with the ornaments, which puts
and trying to turn lamps on and doing other strange things. Mm-hmm. Finally, one of them gets itchy and reaches for a gun, which causes, was it Hoffman shot him or was it Janeway? Janeway shoots the other one to stop him shooting Hoffman.
Yeah.
So Hoffman runs. Janeway shoots Elsa somewhere around the fire area, which kills her dead on the spot. if you actually look at the filming of it, which was fucking awful.
It nicked a major artery.
Just absolutely dead straight away through shooting scarily near a leg.
It's a pressure point. It's a feng shui thing.
He runs out and then shoots back through the window and kills Jane away. And then
shoots him in the face. Come on, give it the full credit.
I mean, he actually does kill him. That's a good kill shot. And then looks mournfully through the window at a dead Elsa.
Doesn't bother to try.
He should just let it go.
I don't know.
It's a Frozen joke there. Oh God. Come on, people.
I got it, but I just tried to not.
Well, at least you got it. Granddad here didn't have a clue.
Throwing a Bambi joke in, he'd have been right on it.
No, I say Elsa was the lion in Born Free. That was all I could think of.
Also in Frozen. Oh, dear.
So the bit that you said to me that, you know, you get to this point in this movie where you picked it up, Paul, and you start thinking, oh, this is getting good, was when Olivier starts getting recognised in the street.
When he's trying to get, I don't know if he's trying to sell the diamonds or get a price.
He's trying to work out what diamonds are worth because he's been in his Uruguayan compound for God knows how long. Yeah. He has no idea.
Because at one point, because he said, oh, yeah, you'll get this much, 15 grand for one carat. I said, what about a 3-carat diamond? Mm. And I'm thinking, fucking hell, that's a big old diamond. And he said something like 80,000 or 90,000 or something. And that's when he got a bit more happy and he comes out, and then the what seems like a scatty woman sort of recognizes him as the Vice Angel. But to be honest, that woman starts screaming stuff like that in the street, you are just going to think she's nuts.
Yeah.
Because you just like haven't got a clue. And it was the more sinister bloke that was at one of the jewelry shops.
He was in the jewelry. Yeah.
Yeah. That starts following him because he just thinks, you can see him just think, oh, where do I know you from, sort of thing. Then obviously the woman gets knocked over a tiny bit by the taxi.
A tiny bit.
Yeah. Run over a little bit. The dream that we all have. You run over a little bit. You're not badly injured, but incapacitated enough so you don't have to go to work for a bit.
I'm not quite dead.
It's the dream. Run over a little bit.
And then he jumps in a cab. Where does he? Oh, he goes to the bank after that.
After he slashes the guy's throat. With the knife of sleeve.
Stabby sleeve.
Yeah, it goes to the bank, and that's when you realise that there's a lot more than just this plaster tin full of diamonds. That there's absolute bucket loads of them. And a bit of cash and God knows what else in there.
Do you genuinely reckon you could just turn up like a sort of jeweler's with a fucking briefcase full of diamonds and just say, how much for this lot? I have a feeling it might be quite difficult to get away with that.
Yeah.
We haven't got 14 billion in the safe, but I'll see what if I'll bring a few people and see what I can do.
I'll have a word with the manager. So at this point, it all starts falling apart again for you, Paul.
No, it was okay. I mean, you realise that all this caper, I'm putting it lightly, was not just over a handful of diamonds. It was over millions and millions worth of diamonds. And you sort of realise the sort of thing of why it was. Is it safe? All that sort of retrospectively comes back into view and you realize what he was doing. Obviously, as soon as he comes out with this briefcase full of this stuff is when Hoffman approaches him, shows him he's got a gun in his hoodie pocket.
It isn't safe.
And just takes him to this pump house, which is handily left the door open so they could get in. and the worker in there, obviously, if someone shows a gun, they're going to bugger off. But if someone frightens you out of your workplace with a gun, I think I'd call the police. And I think police
the United States, it's what happens. Yeah,
I think the police might be there quite quickly. But
yeah, I would.
another 5-10 minute scene sort of exists afterwards where they, it's not even a fight, is it? It's just Dustin Hoffman wants him to eat the diamonds for some sadistic reason. You can keep what you can eat after he's thrown a few million dollars down into the water. The one thing about that scene that gets me is you don't quite know what happens at the end, because spoiler alert, in case no one's seen it, Olivier's character, after panicking and trying to get the diamonds, falls down the stairs and impales himself quite poetically on his own blade.
What a fucking idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. And there, still floating within reach, is the briefcase with quite a few diamonds left in it. Now, I don't know about you gents, but if I was going to run away from that scene, I might just go down the stairs and get that briefcase before I fuck off. But now,
there was a scene filmed or written in the script where Dustin Hoffman is led away by the police.
Okay.
After that. There's a lot of stuff missing, isn't there, from this film, Ben? That was
the end's changed as well. Yeah. From the book, it's different.
Yeah.
I know with films, especially of that era and that ilk, there is that penchant for leaving a little bit to the imagination, for not quite ending it, getting to the end and then stopping and going, well, you can imagine if he got away with it. You can imagine if he got arrested, sort of thing. But it would have been nice for at least to see him sort of pick up that briefcase. It's a bit I think Italian Job and hanging over a cliff with a coach full of gold.
What confuses me about the way this ends in comparison to how I know it, the book ends, is that they go, because obviously, as you say, Zell rolls down the stairs and stabs himself on his ridiculous sleeve knife and dies. It's almost as if it's written that way to sort of, you know, not blame Hoffman. He's innocent. You know, he wasn't forced into doing the ultimate bad thing, but he's already killed two people by this point. So it really doesn't matter.
He's an angel.
I'd have been written so he'd somehow managed to get through this whole, you know, adventure without actually killing anybody, then the end would make a bit more sense, because you think, okay, at least he's got his life. But I know in the original ending, in the book, I think it ends in Central Park, and he just shoots the guy several times at point blank range and then throws the diamonds in the bin, which kind of makes more sense, I think.
Yeah, I mean, what's the point of killing like William Devane and the other guys without killing the main Nazi? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and to be honest, if you're going to get caught and put away for murder, you might as well try and get away with a few million dollars worth of diamonds.
Right, yeah, swallow a few. Yeah.
That would have been one.
Yeah.
Dustin Hoffman could have chucked a few down his gob.
Yeah, if he did get caught, just keep hold of one till he's released. Yeah.
So, any final thoughts on Marathon Man, guys?
I think for a movie in the mid to late 70s, I can understand why it was big then. Made a lot of the box office, like four times what it cost. And obviously with the cast, with Hoffman, with Schneider. I keep calling him Schneider. That's someone else.
I always call him Schneider.
And Olivier. It's going to bring in a lot of people to watch it. I wonder how many people, adults in the 70s who sat down to watch that, really enjoyed it, or is it one of those movies that the critics really loved?
Oh, okay.
Because, again, I think, like myself and like Ben recalling his first watch, and yourself, like confusion for the first 3/4 hour at least. I didn't hate the film. I can't say I liked it either. I think I might enjoy it much more on a second watch, knowing that I know what the fuck is actually going on. Because you won't sit there and go so confused, and you will know that every part of the first 45 minutes has purpose to it. Yeah, it's not the worst film I've seen. It's not ever going to be in my top 50 films I've ever watched. It had its purpose, it had its day. I do think if you sat down anyone sort of 20, 30 year old today to watch that film for the first time, they would struggle with it.
Okay, yeah. Ben, how was it for you this time round, mate?
My opinion hasn't differed much on it, even my newfound discovery of dentistry aside. you know, I've always quite liked it, and I've never quite understood exactly why I like it as much as I do. Because I do, I think that the narrative is really disjointed. I think that some of it is a little, could have been a lot more nuanced. I think it's a bit of I could accuse it of being a bit ham-fisted. There's elements of magic in there. I love how it looks. I think it's a fantastic film to look at. I love the fact that it really captures that mid-70s grit. And you get that real globetrotting feel that it goes for. You know, you really feel like you're in these places all over the world. I like the intrigue and the mystery, but I would agree with what Paul has said, is that there needs to be more breadcrumb. My biggest criticism, I think, of this film is how it's edited. I think in the hands of a different editor, I think it could have had a much more fulfilling watch. I can see why it gets the plaudits it does, because I think that some of the acting is extraordinarily good. In fact, I think that there's not a weak link, I would argue, acting wise. And therefore, you've got to give the director credit for that as well, I would say. So my issues are with how the finished film turned out. And, you know, again, I gather there was, you know, the original author wasn't happy with how the film turned out, you know, as is often the case as well. And you do wonder what kind of struggles went on in the editing room, or in, you know, executives saying, well, this is the film we want, and, you know, hence the changed end and other things. But no, I think it's certainly memorable. I mean, and not just for the dentistry scene, there are several elements about it that I think are worthy of coming up in wider conversation about films. So I like it. I couldn't put it in my top 20, 25, 30 films, but it's one of those films I'm really pleased to have seen, and really pleased to have seen a few times, so I can remember it and talk reasonably, you know, sort of confidently about it. I have a feeling it's one of those films that people will lie about having seen, because it's
I think
the people will get 20 minutes in and think, oh, bollocks to this, I've that's enough, I've seen it.
Okay.
But I do think it compares better, you know, to some other films that might be mentioned in the same breath from the same era. I think it's much more rewatchable than, you know, things that may be my go-to when I'm talking about that kind of thing is The Deer Hunter. That's a film I've seen once and I ain't ever going to watch that again. I've done it though. I don't need to watch it again. Yeah. You know, I have a feeling that it might come into that category for some people as well. But no, I'll say I like it. The film.
For me, top 20 movie. Across the board, if you were judging this by the amount of times you've watched a movie in your lifetime, Marathon Man will be one of the ones I've watched the most. And for some inexplicable reason, it just attracts me. And I think Ben sort of hinted at this in what he was saying. It just draws you in for some reason. And Paul, I think by the second viewing, give it a couple of years, watch it in a couple of years' time, you'll probably find that you go, actually, you know, you watch this.
I did say, now knowing what it's all about, the second watch will be easier. And I think that's half the trouble. It was a difficult watch. Not difficult because it was disturbing or anything along that just line. It was difficult to understand. It was difficult to realize why they started with a bit of road rage and then why this guys running around the park.
You watch that from the beginning, you go, right, okay, that's so and so's brother, and related to that. And you'll just be a bit more relaxed while you watch it. And for me, I'm not lying, I watch this every couple of years. And Paul's shaking his head, Ben, I don't know if you saw that.
I did.
But then we do.
This
have
is the guy that thinks gremlins are real.
I'm not guilty in saying that I enjoy watching this movie. And in the same breath, I will always put this in a double bill with Boys from Brazil that I think Ben might have seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're watching, isn't that what Adam
chose?
We're
watching it with Kev.
Oh, Kev.
Ben is more than welcome to join us for that, because it's only the fact that Laurence Olivier plays a totally opposite character to what he plays in this movie. He plays a Nazi in this one. He plays a Nazi hunter in The Boys from Brazil. And you've got, you've got everybody from, you know, Gregory Peck playing you know, some crazy Nazi, what's his name in it? Anyway, with Marathon Man, I just like the fact that it's been a film that's been with me for nearly 40 years. And for some reason, it's just one of those ones that's always appealed to me. And I just go back to it. It's a comfort movie almost. Yeah. I don't know why.
I can understand. If you'd have seen it 40 years ago, I can understand, because then it would have been still reasonably new.
Yeah.
You watch it with different eyes back then. Unfortunately, I've missed it all these years, so I'm watching it, seeing it's dated.
Yeah.
And yes, certain films in that era you can watch and watch again, and you, things like American Graffiti, which was a few years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You watch that now and you don't see when it was filmed.
Because it was a period piece.
Yeah. And it's just, I think I've left it too long. Yeah. If I'd have watched this 20, 30 years ago, I'd have had a different opinion of it. But because it's such a big gap, almost 50 years ago, again, I do think on a second watch, I'll appreciate it more. But at this stage, it would be a very low sort of 5 out of 10 if I was to give it a mark.
Okay. Three different opinions on, you know, a remarkable movie from the mid-70s.
Is it safe?
Are you talking to me?
Is it safe?
What's safe?
Is it safe?
I don't know what you mean.
I can't tell you if something is safe or not. Unless I know specifically what you're talking about. Is it safe?
Tell me what it refers to.
Is it safe?
Yes, it's safe. It's very safe. It's so safe you wouldn't believe it.
Is it safe?
No, it's not safe. It's very dangerous. Be careful.
No, I should think it would. Should take better care of your teeth. You have quite a cavity here. Is it safe?
Look, I tell you, I can't do it.
You think he knows?
Of course he knows he's being very stubborn.
Simple oil of cloves, and how amazing the results. Life can be that simple. Relief, discomfort. Now, which of these I next apply, that decision is in your hands. So, take your time. Tell me, is it safe?
Had blanks, the knife a retractable blade, hardly original, but
effective enough. I think you'll agree.
I'm told you are graduate students. Brilliant, yeah? You're an historian, and I'm part of history. I should have thought you would have found me interesting.
Frankly, I'm disappointed in your silence.
Why do you have so little accent?
I had alexia as a child. Alexia is a disease.
I know, it's where you can't understand written speech.
Highest marks. At any event, my writing is childish still, but I'm a fanatic about spoken language. I envy you your school days. Enjoy them fully. It's the last time in your life. No one expects anything of you.
I know. I behaved terribly. But I had to be sure what you knew, you see.
I'm positive your brother meant to rob me when I
left
the bank with my diamonds.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know anything.
Was Scylla planning the robbery alone?
Robbery?
You know the value of diamonds?
No, I don't.
Neither do I, not in today's market.
Tomorrow I must go and find out before I go to the bank.
You see,
your brother was incredibly strong. Strength is often inherited.
He died in your arms. He traveled far and in great pain to do that.
Has to be a reason.
I don't know anything.
Carl!
Oh, please don't worry. I'm not going into that cafeteria. That nerve's already dying. A live, freshly cut nerve is infinitely more sensitive.
So, I'll just drill into a healthy tooth until I reach the pulse. Unless, of course, you can tell me that it's safe.
And now, preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
That was Marathon Man from 1976. Now, Ben has quite graciously agreed to come back after that malarkey. To help us celebrate still our 10th anniversary. We're going to keep doing this until the end of the year. We're just doggedly going to carry on, man. We just had a little chat in the break. And we sort of come up, like Ben has come up with a bit of a brainwave, actually. One of the movies we reviewed a few years back was Wages of Fear.
Never heard of it.
Never heard of it. No, didn't think so. French movie.
Oh, dear.
Am I right, Ben? It's about transporting dynamite in a lorry, basically, is the premise of the story. That's all you need to know. Yeah,
it's not the job you'd want, put it that way.
So. Yeah.
And 0 hours contract. There's nothing on this.
So what happened the year after Marathon Man, I think it was 77, William Friedkin, who was the director of Exorcist, remade it as a film called Sorcerer, starring Roy Scheider. Yep. Ben has suggested that will be the next movie that we review when we get together. So we're not necessarily going to do a re-review. We're going to do a review of a remake of a movie that we've reviewed.
That sort of makes sense. That's tenuous link, but yeah.
I think it's one of the best movies of the 70s. Ben, just a gentle hint as your feelings on it.
I absolutely love it.
Absolutely love it.
Best movies of the 70s.
Alright, quite a big shot there. I'm sorry, a big shout, but...
Better than Badlands, better than Paper.
You haven't seen Moon. It, mate.
I think it's fair to say it's one of the best films that not as many people have seen or heard of.
Right, okay. Yeah. An unsung one.
And I think it's getting the recognition now.
Well, yeah, I've just read the synopsis, and it sounds really interesting. It sounds like I might enjoy that. So I'm happy with that, Ben.
Just a word of warning, when you watch the first thing, it's the first two scenes, don't worry, it's not all in foreign. There is some English.
It's just not all in foreign.
Yeah.
I understand some foreign.
You don't have to read this movie.
Yeah.
I can't do two things at once, read and watch.
Ben, thank you so much for tonight.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
Really great time.
Didn't put it in.
Can you just let the audience of one or two, how many there are now still listening after these 10 years, where they can find your two magnificent podcasts, sir?
Yes, I churn out every fortnight. We're working our way through the back catalogue of the Films of Hammer Studios in the House of Hammer podcast. There's the three of us working our way through there. We're currently in the mid-1950s. Haven't got to any horror films yet, if that's all you know Hammer Studios for, but we will do eventually one day. But if you do like horror films, you'll also find me on the Rated H podcast, where me and my partner Smokey, well, that's not romantic partner, by the way, that's business stroke podcast partner. Here we work our way through nothing in any particular order. We just pick a horror film that we want to talk about every sort of roughly every month or so, and do that and have a lot of fun doing it.
Thoroughly recommend both of those podcasts. Okay, that's it from us. Keep listening, guys. We've got another 10 years at least left in us. I've been Scott. He's been Paul. He's been Ben. Thank you, guys. This has been the Singing Pools podcast. See you soon. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
The management of this theater suggests that for the greater entertainment of your friends who have not yet seen the picture, you will not divulge to anyone the secret of the ending.
Bastard arms! That infernal jamboree is worse than two cats on a fence!
You dudes get lost now, you hear?
Good night, ladies!
Good night, sir!
When you feel down, try positive thinking. That's what I told the man, said, don't wear a frown, try positive thinking, laugh at your troubles instead. You've got to look on the bright side, on hope so much depends. With your confidence sinking, positive thinking helps you on the way, my friend. When things look black, try positive thinking, treat every season as spring. No glancing back, try positive thinking, trust what tomorrow may bring. This crazy world that we live in will keep on spinning round, but with good, strong, positive thinking, we'll get together and life won't let us down.
Shut up, you ugly bitch.
Oh, shut up, we enjoy it.